It was summer, and the Hudson River water was a brisk 72 degrees. Pitt opted for a neoprene quarter-inch wetsuit with pads on the knees and elbows. A weight belt with light weights to counteract the buoyancy of the wetsuit was clamped around his waist. He pulled on a pair of gloves, his fins and hood, before slicking the inside of his mask and pulling it over his head with the snorkel dangling. The water was as transparent as glass for 30 feet before it faded into the gloom turned green with clouds of minuscule algae. Pitt hyperventilated and curled forward, lifting his legs and using their weight air to push him downward in an effortless dive. The great jagged rocks were massed together like pieces of an ill-fitting jigsaw puzzle. Pitt and Giordino soon realized they were not in the right area, because this part of the slope disappeared toward the center of the river too gradually. They surfaced for air and decided to split the search. Pitt would head up, and Giordino would follow the rocky shore downriver. Suddenly, Pitt swam over an open stretch free of rocks. The bottom was now smooth and flat, with a channel cut through the rubble. He sucked a cubic foot of air into his lungs before holding his breath and diving down to look for an opening through the jagged fall of rock. Al had climbed back on the boat, having found nothing of interest. Kelly was sitting on top of the cabin, her feet on the deck of the bow, staring in Pitt's direction. Expelling the last of his air, Pitt returned to the surface. He waved both arms and yelled, "I found a way inside!" Kelly and Giordino needed no further urging. In less than 3 minutes, they were stroking against the current beside him. They swam through the narrow section of the tunnel, their fins brushing against the sides and disturbing the growth into a green diaphanous cloud. Finally, just as Kelly was beginning to fear that she only had a few seconds left before opening her mouth and taking in a mouthful of water, the cavity fanned out, and she gripped Pitt's left ankle, using his momentum to propel her to the surface. Their heads came free of the water in unison. They spit out the mouthpieces of their snorkels, raised the dive masks over their heads, and found themselves in an immense cavern whose roof towered 200 feet above their heads. Pitt gazed up in wonder at the head of a serpent with bared fangs that was staring down at him, as if searching for a distant shore. On an enormous ledge 4 feet above the water's edge, 6 open wooden boats, held upright by their keels and wedged by wooden cradles, sat side by side, stern to bow. The serpent rose on the bow post of the largest boat nearest the rim of the ledge. The boats were built entirely of oak, the largest stretching more than 60 feet in length. The divers could look up at the keels and the broad, symmetrically arched hulls with their clinker-built, overlapping strake planking that was still held together with rusting iron rivets. Below the rack, where shields had once been stored, oars still protruded through small, round ports. "They're Viking," Kelly murmured in astonished awe. "They've been here all the time and nobody knew." "Your father knew," said Pitt. "He knew from the Viking inscriptions that they had settled on the Palisades above the Hudson River, which led him to the discovery of the tunnel leading down to the cavern from above." After removing their fins, face masks, and weight belts, they climbed a rock-chiseled stairway to the top of the ledge and mounted the boarding ramps to the upper strake of the largest ship. The ramps were sound and obviously put there by Dr. Egan. The light inside the cavern was dim, but they recognized what looked like a body wrapped in a burial shroud. On each side were smaller bundles in shrouds. Around the bodies, a treasure trove of artifacts had been literally dumped in scattered disarray. There were gilt-bronzed figures of saints, a stack of illuminated manuscripts in Gospel Latin, and reliquary boxes filled with coins and silver chalices, most likely all stolen from monasteries during raids on England and Ireland. Amber necklaces, gold and silver brooches, elaborate silver and bronze necklaces and bracelets lay in piles inside elaborately carved wooden boxes. Bronze dishes and incense burners from the Orient, along with furniture, textiles, and linen, and a beautifully carved sled for the chief to be towed on in winter snow, were also lying about. "My guess is this is Bjarn Sigvitsson," said Pitt. Kelly looked sadly at the two smaller bundles. "They must be his children." Pitt motioned toward the boarding ramp. "Let's have a look at the other boats." To Kelly's horror, the adjacent boats were strewn with bones, intermingled with broken and shattered household goods. Few skeletons were intact. Pitt knelt and studied a skull with a jagged gash in the top of the cranium. There must have been a terrible massacre. "Could they have fought among themselves?" Kelly asked.
"I don't think so," said Giordino. He removed an arrow that was embedded between the ribs of one pile of bones and held it up. "This says Indians."
"It also lends credibility to the legend Marlis told us of Indians slaughtering all the Vikings in the settlement." Kelly looked at Pitt.
"Then the Norse settlement?"
"Was located on your father's farm?" Pitt finished. "He found artifacts and was influenced to launch his research project."